Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again from Washington. I'm Jim Tedder. We come to you every day to help you learn and improve your American English. We do this by telling you interesting stories from around the world. But we present them slowly and with words that are easy to understand. It is a great way to learn to speak the American way. Today, Jonathan Evans joins us to present three items for you to hear. The first deals with a new public transportation idea. Then we will travel to Kenya to hear why some Catholic church leaders are telling people not to take their medicine. And we will also hear about a way to get around censorship on the Internet. So let's get started. In the United States, a company is working on a project that could change the way we think about public transportation. Its planned system would move people around in steel tubes. Jonathan Evans reports.
The futuristic steel tube transportation system is called Hyperloop. Workers plan to test the system next year in a specially built community called Quay Valley. The town will be powered entirely by energy from the sun. The Hyperloop transport system is the idea of businessman Elon Musk. Dirk Allborn is head of Hyperloop Transportation Technologies. He says his company has taken Mr. Musk's idea and is developing a system that will be safe, environmentally friendly, and fast.
It's 100% solar powered. We're not going to get up to 760 miles per hour, but we believe that we can actually break the records that are existing right now.
This means that a four-hour drive from Los Angeles, California to Las Vegas, Nevada could someday take only 30 minutes by Hyperloop. The system involves a series of capsules that float inside a long tube. These containers would not need to travel along a pathway or track. The system has been designed to operate above or below ground.
Inside the tube, you create a low-pressure environment, very similar to an airplane that's on high altitudes. So now the capsule traveling inside the tube doesn't encounter as much resistance and therefore can travel really fast with very little energy.
Dirk Allborn and his company will use an 8-kilometer track in Quay Valley to find the best way to set up passenger traffic and repair capsules. A larger system will cost an estimated $6 to $10 billion to build. If Mr. Allborn and his company succeed, we may one day see these very fast Hyperloop capsules speeding through tubes around the world.
You are listening to VOA, and we are coming to you from Washington. The international campaign to end the paralyzing and sometimes deadly disease polio has been weakened in recent years by clergymen in some Muslim countries. They believe the campaign is part of a plot to stop Muslim children from being able to have babies when they grow older. Now, top Catholic clergymen in Kenya are also calling for people to reject the polio vaccine. In Kenya's capital, Nairobi, workers from the Ministry of Health give shots to children. They are immunizing the children against polio. Mary Samula is a teacher. She welcomes the workers into her home. She says she wants her new baby to be protected. The Ministry of Health says it hopes to immunize 6 million children when its polio immunization campaign ends in early September. Roman Catholic leaders in the East African nation have called on people to reject the vaccine. But Ms. Samula, who is Catholic, wants her baby to have it.
I'd like my baby to be immunized because I don't want my child to be paralyzed. That's the first thing. And also, I listen to my own voice. I like my baby to grow up as a normal child.
When the campaign began this summer, Kenya's Catholic bishops called on people to boycott the vaccines. They said the medicine had not been tested. The bishops also said the vaccines were secretly designed to stop Kenyans from being able to have babies. They had said similar things earlier this year when the government began a campaign to immunize people against tetanus. Cardinal John Njue is the Archbishop of Nairobi.
We are in a status where now we must be able to kind of determine our own destiny.
Dr. Nicholas Muraguri is the Director of Medical Services at the Health Ministry. He says the bishops have no reason to oppose the campaigns. He says the vaccine is safe. VOA spoke with Catholic officials in other parts of the world. They would not speak about the decision by Kenya's bishops to oppose the polio vaccination campaign. They would only say local religious leaders have a responsibility to protect the members of their church. But Catholic church leaders do approve of vaccines. They have said in publications that vaccinations protect lives and public health. This is the Voice of America. Now let's turn back to Jonathan for some internet and technology news. Jonathan?
It is called the Amnesic Incognito Live System, or TAILS. In computer terms, a live system is a standalone operating system that runs directly off a DVD, or increasingly, a USB memory stick. A live system uses only a computer's RAM. None of the operating files are saved anywhere. Once downloaded to a portable disk drive or USB, users simply connect TAILS to any computer and run it. When taken out of the computer, the live system leaves no evidence of ever being used on the computer. Chris Doten says TAILS comes with additional security applications that users can easily access. There's also a multi-protocol chat client that can speak to Facebook, Google Chat, and others called Pigeon, he added. A growing number of journalists and rights groups are using TAILS. The nonprofit group Reporters Without Borders works in support of freedom of the press. It has suggested TAILS for journalists who need to protect their sources. Activists in Tibet use TAILS to securely document human rights abuses there by the Chinese government. And groups working to fight violence within families are now using TAILS to report abuse and protect victims' identities. But the same system that helps protect human rights activists can be used by hackers, criminals, or terrorists to hide their identity and activities online. Mr. Doten said the real concern should be how often internet activists, journalists, and others are targeted online and then punished for their activities. I'm frankly shocked at the state of digital security among U.S. journalists, he said. People who have real dangers that they've seen externally and internally at times. The fact that newsrooms around the country, even the big ones, are not investing more in this, I think, is a real crime. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. This is The Voice of America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Environment and Science Report. Most of us rarely think about the Earth's magnetic field. We might know that it helps guide birds as they travel and keeps our compasses pointing north. But the magnetic field is much more. It is one of the main components that make life on the planet possible. However, the processes in the Earth's core that create the magnetic field are poorly understood. Now, scientists at the University of Maryland are working to reproduce the conditions that lie 3,000 kilometers below our feet. Deep inside Earth is a 3,400-kilometer-wide ball of liquid metals, iron and nickel. In the center is a smaller ball of solid iron. They combine to form what is called Earth's core. The core creates the electric currents responsible for Earth's magnetic field. The most immediate benefit is its part in navigation. Daniel Lathrop is a physics professor at the University of Maryland. He runs the laboratory where Earth's magnetic field is studied.
And the Earth's main magnetic field is a very important part of what makes the Earth a habitable planet, because it shields us from a lot of the worst parts of radiation from the sun.
Evidence shows that the Earth's magnetic field is not fixed in place. The strength of the field changes direction.
What we do know is the Earth's magnetic field has reversed north-south hundreds of times in Earth's history. And so that the spin of the Earth stays the same, but where the magnetic pole is moves and has actually reversed.
Mr. Lathrop and his team are trying to find out how and why that happens. The researchers built a 3-meter-wide steel ball that turns. The ball is filled with 12.5 tons of sodium to reproduce the Earth's outer core. Sodium is a soft metal that melts at just under 100 degrees Celsius. A 1-meter-wide inner non-magnetic steel ball is used to represent Earth's solid iron core. Both can be turned independently. But turning them slowly has not created a process known as the dynamo effect. The dynamo effect is thought to be responsible for creating magnetic fields.
We only see magnetic fields when we impose small magnetic fields from the outside, although we see that imposing small magnetic fields from the outside, we get a factor of 10 larger magnetic fields induced by the flow. So we have a very effective at half-speed gain of magnetic fields without having what we call a dynamo, which is something that just starts on its own and grows a full size. So now we're aiming then to go to full speed.
Mr. Lathrop says it is difficult to predict changes that happen over thousands of years.
1 second of operation of the experiment models 5,000 years of evolution of the magnetic field. So the goal is to take data from the experiment to do mock predictions, and then you can improve the predictions.
Mr. Lathrop notes that the strength of Earth's magnetic field has dropped about 10% in the last 170 years. This means the reversal process may have already started, but the change is too slow to affect our everyday lives. And that's the VOA Learning English Environment and Science Report. For more environment and science programs, go to our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. Keep listening for our program on American history, The Making of a Nation. I'm Jonathan Evans.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Today we continue our story of the United States Constitution. In recent weeks, we discussed how the Constitution was written. In the summer of 1787, a group of delegates gathered for a convention in Philadelphia. Their plan was to rewrite the Articles of Confederation. Those articles created a weak union of the 13 states. Instead of rewriting the articles, however, they spent that summer writing a completely new plan of government. On September 17th, after 4 months of often bitter debate, the delegates finally agreed to the new plan. Now they had to get at least 9 of the 13 states to approve it. Delegates to the Philadelphia Convention had met in secret. They wanted to be able to debate proposals and change their minds without worrying about public reaction. Now they were free to speak openly. Each had a copy of the new Constitution. Newspapers also had copies. They published every word. Public reaction was great indeed. Arguments for and against were the same as those voiced by delegates to the convention. The Constitution would save the United States. The Constitution would create a dictator. Yale Law School professor Akhil Reed Amar says the public debate about the Constitution was one of its first successes as a democratic document. He notes that even democracies of long ago, like those in Greece or Italy, did not let citizens vote on their constitutions.
People could be for the Constitution or against it. No one was shut down. No one was put in prison if they liked George Washington or they didn't like George Washington. Just this proliferation, robust, wide open, uninhibited discourse up and down a continent.
Supporters of the new Constitution understood that to win ratification, they needed to speak out. So a few weeks after the document was signed, they began writing statements in support of the proposed Constitution. Their statements appeared first in newspapers in New York. They were called the Federalist Papers. They were published under the name of Publius, but they were really written by three men, Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and John Jay. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas says he deeply respects the men who wrote the Federalist Papers.
These are people who were engaged, who knew the Constitution. Also want you to know, these were not scholars. These were farmers. These were business people. Some of them who had formal education. Some who did not, but they cared about this country.
Years later, historians said the Federalist Papers were the greatest explanation of the Constitution ever written. But in 1787, they had little effect on public opinion. The debate over the Constitution divided Americans into two groups. Those who supported it were known as Federalists. Those who opposed it were known as Anti-Federalists. The Anti-Federalists were not anti-American. They were governors, heroes of the Revolutionary War, and even a future president. Yet they distrusted the idea of a strong central government. Give too much power to the president, Congress, and the courts, they said, and citizens would no longer be free. They would lose the liberties gained in the war for independence from Britain. Law professor Akhil Reed Amar says the anti-federalists were an important part of the debate and of history.
The people who oppose the Constitution think it could be better still. They're not cast out. They become presidents of the United States, vice presidents of the United States, justices on the Supreme Court. It's extraordinary how they're kept in the process.
There were both Federalists and anti-Federalists in the Continental Congress. The Congress had few powers, but it was the only central government the 13 states had at that time. It met in New York City. The convention in Philadelphia had sent the Continental Congress a copy of the new Constitution. Within 8 days, the Congress agreed that each state should organize a convention to discuss ratification. One by one, the states held those meetings. Delaware was the first state to ratify early in December 1787. All the delegates voted to approve it. Pennsylvania was the next to ratify, also in December. New Jersey ratified the Constitution in December, followed by Georgia and Connecticut in January. That made 5 states. The Federalists needed just 4 more to win ratification. Massachusetts voted in early February. Delegates to the state convention wanted the Constitution amended to include guarantees to protect citizens' rights. They agreed to ratify if these guarantees were added later. Maryland ratified the Constitution at the end of April. There, a number of delegates included a letter of protest with their vote. They said, if the plan of government were not amended, the liberty and happiness of the people would be threatened. At the end of May, South Carolina became the 8th state to ratify. Just 1 more state, and the new Constitution would become the law of the land. All eyes turned to Virginia. Virginia was the biggest of the 13 states. 1/5 of all the people in America lived in Virginia. The men who attended the ratifying convention were among the most famous names in the nation: James Madison, Patrick Henry, George Mason, James Monroe, Edmund Randolph, and John Marshall. The most famous Virginian, George Washington, stayed at his home, Mount Vernon. All during the month of June, however, riders brought him messages from the convention and carried messages back. Thomas Jefferson was still in Paris, serving as America's representative to France. But others kept him informed of everything that happened at home. Jefferson wrote back that he liked most of the Constitution, but he said, I do not like the fact that it does not contain a declaration of the rights of citizens. For 3 weeks, the Virginia delegates argued about the Constitution. By the end of June, they were ready to vote. Patrick Henry, the outspoken anti-Federalist, asked to make a final statement. If this convention approves the Constitution, Henry said, I will feel that I fought for good reasons and lost the fight. If this happens, I will wait and hope. I will hope that the spirit of the American Revolution is not lost. I will hope that this new plan of government is changed to protect the safety, the liberty, and the happiness of the American people. Then the convention voted. Virginia approved the Constitution. However, like Massachusetts, it added that the document must include a Declaration of Rights for the nation's people. Federalists in Virginia thought their state was the ninth to ratify, the one that made the Constitution the law of the land. But they soon learned that New Hampshire had ratified a few days earlier. Virginia was number 10. That left three states, North Carolina, Rhode Island, and New York. In a way, New York was the most important of all. If New York refused to join the Union under the Constitution, it would be almost impossible for a central government to rule the nation. The 12 other states would be divided in two, geographically separated by New York State. Alexander Hamilton was a leader of the Federalists. They used their right to filibuster to make many long speeches to delay the vote. They wanted to wait to hear what Virginia would do. Early in July, they got the news. But New York's anti-Federalists kept up the fight for three more weeks. It was not until the end of July that New York finally ratified the Constitution. The vote was extremely close, 30-27. Like Massachusetts and Virginia, New York demanded a Declaration of Rights. The long struggle to give the United States a strong central government was over. It took 4 months to write a new constitution. It took 10 months to ratify it. Yale Law School professor Akhil Reed Amar says adopting the Constitution was, in his words, the most democratic deed in history.
For the first time ever in the history of the planet, an entire continent got to vote on how they and their posterity would be governed. And there were lots of exclusions, you know, from our perspective, but we wouldn't exist, you know, as a democratic country, as a democratic world, but for that.
The Continental Congress declared that the Constitution would become effective the first Wednesday in March, 1789. The last two states, North Carolina and Rhode Island, did not approve it until many months after that date. Benjamin Rush of Pennsylvania, who had signed the Declaration of Independence, wrote down 8 words when he heard that the Constitution had been ratified. "It is done," he said. "We have become a nation." But before that, the nation's founders had one more question to answer. How would the Constitution guarantee citizens' rights? Delegates at the convention had raised the point many times, and several states made protecting citizens' rights a condition for approving the document. The Bill of Rights will be our story next week. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us again next week here at VOA Learning English for The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English.